Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This is Pop Culture Confidential, and I'm Christina Yerling Biru. Hey everyone, welcome to Pop Culture Confidential. Thanks so much for being here. I'm really thrilled to have the opportunity to speak to award-winning composer-producer Ludvig Göransson on the occasion of the premiere of Christopher Nolan's much-awaited epic film Oppenheimer. The Oppenheimer score, another incredible achievement by Göransson. Göransson's varied career is already iconic. He's scored films such as Fruitvale Station and Creed. He won the Best Original Score Oscar for Black Panther. For TV, he's worked on Community, and his Mandalorian score is already part of the pop cultural landscape. As a producer, he has frequently collaborated with Childish Gambino, produced Kendrick Lamar, Rihanna, just to name a few. Oppenheimer is his second musical collaboration with Nolan. His first was Tenet, a sensation, a score that you can really feel deep down in your psyche, in your bones. He mirrored the film's time inversion theme by reverse engineering the musical soundscape and by using Chris Nolan's own breath for that otherworldly effect. Nolan's Oppenheimer is based on the biography American Prometheus about J. Robert Oppenheimer, the theoretical physicist whose work was pivotal in the development of the first nuclear weapons as part of the Manhattan Project. With this project, we can sense themes that Nolan seems to have been exploring through his whole body of work: science, obsessive characters, and moral questions of cause and effect. In my talk with Göransson, we explored how he worked with Nolan and his themes musically. For Oppenheimer, Nolan suggested to Göransson that he base the score on the violin to mirror the high-strung nature of Oppenheimer, brilliance, moral ambiguity, and a momentous historical event. More on that after this. Here is Oppenheimer.
This is a national emergency.
Detonator charged.
We're in a race against the Nazis. And I know what it means. If the Nazis have a bomb,
they have a 12-month head start.
18.
How could you possibly know that?
We've got one hope.
All America's industrial might and scientific innovation connected here.
A secret laboratory. Keep everyone there until it's done.
Let's go recruit some scientists.
Build a town, build it fast. If we don't let scientists bring their families, we'll never get the best.
Why would we go to the middle of nowhere for who knows how long?
Why? Why? How about because this is the most important thing to ever happen in the history of the world?
You're the great improviser, but this, you can't do in your head.
Are we saying there's a chance that when we push that button, we destroy the world?
Chances are near zero.
Near zero.
What do you want from theory alone?
Zero would be nice.
Ludvig Göransson, welcome to the show, and thank you so much for this tremendous achievement that you have done again with Nolan and Oppenheimer.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
So I read an interview with Chris Nolan a while back, and he said, quote, "People have asked if I would ever make a musical, and I'm like, they're all musicals," end quote. And having made a couple of works with him musically, do you get what he means by that?
Absolutely. I mean, music in his movies are it's like a character, right? It's the space and the emphasis that he has with music and storytelling is very unique. And I saw that from the very beginning when I was, you know, when I grew up and watching his movies and seeing what it did with Dave Julian and Hans Zimmer and seeing, you know, and then seeing those movies and getting that feel from the music, it was extremely inspiring. And so being able to work with him and having this collaborationship has meant a lot to me. And just, you know, it feels like we're discovering, and everything, every time we work together, it feels like we're discovering new paths in music that I haven't, you know, I haven't done before. So
we're going to get back to talking about your work with him, but describing J. Robert Oppenheimer, I mean, he's truly a trinity, to use that word, true polymath. He was fascinated by philosophy, poetry, music. He was also, of course, in physics. He could see things in different dimensions and he could be volatile. Such an enigma. How did you approach him musically?
Yeah, that was a challenge because as soon as I read the script, I realized, like, this is written from first-person perspective. You know, you're as a reader, as an audience member, you're experiencing the movie through his eyes. So I realized pretty quickly that the music needs to feel like you're with him and like you're in his emotional state at all times. So, and his emotional state is, you know, obviously he's a genius, but there's a lot of complexity in there. And so the musical spectrum had to be, you know, there's the tonality of it had, there's a lot of ground to cover. And so that was the big challenge.
Since the movie is so much about morality, what does guilt sound like to you?
Well, in this movie in particular, the one thing Chris was mentioning early on in the process was that he wanted to explore the sound of violin to portray Oppenheimer. And especially because it's the violin is a fretless instrument, so you can just hold down a note, and then depending on the strength of the bow arm and the vibrato, you can make it, you can turn it from like something beautiful, romantic, into something neurotic and horrific within a split of a second. And I think that state, how you can go into those feelings, and balance those feelings in a very interesting way. That's
interesting. So the violin has this paradoxical, you can go from one state of mind to another.
Exactly. You know, you can start the tone feeling like, okay, this is about to be something beautiful. And then within a second, like it just ends on a completely like heartbreaking, horrific note. And I think that is what we was trying to embody with the emotional core of Oppenheimer, you know, and especially because we're portraying him like, you know, pre-Trinity and post-Trinity and him realizing, you know, the effects of what he did.
So musically, what was pre and what is post-Trinity?
I feel like there's two elements of the score. And the first element, which is the violin and the strings, you know, we have a solo violin that feels, you know, extremely like intimate. And then as the movie goes on, like the solo violins is joined by four violins and then a whole string orchestra. So you have the dynamic range of that sound. And then on the other hand, you have, and that's how I started writing the music. Everything was organic. I wanted to feel the most important part of all in the beginning was to feel the emotional core. So I wanted to write all the music with just live performance players and organic. But then we have throughout the whole movie, there's a feeling of the impending doom, right? And that's where we get the electronic elements in the modern production and those kind of synths that feels like they're drawing you down, you know, to the bottom of a bottomless pit, you know, and it was the juxtaposition between those two worlds that for me, I thought was very interesting.
And in terms of sound design, I understand that you often use real world sounds in your compositions. What did you do for this one, if any?
Well, for this one, you know, there was some sound design that Chris had experimented with a lot in the beginning, which was the sound of footsteps. And something that I realized when I was done with the movie and I was watching down the movie was, like, I realized pretty quickly that, oh my God, there's, you know, 2 hours and 40 minutes of music, but there's no percussion in it. And there's something that we never really talked about it, but I realized that, you know, we have footsteps, and, you know, it's such a essence and such an important sound of the movie. And also I think that the way it those footsteps just comes out, because there's no percussion, there's no other rhythmic elements in it, so it just, you feel the threat of that even more, you know. And
yeah, correct me if I'm wrong, it's two very powerful moments, one with Gene Tatlock where it's very mm-hmm. emotional, and one where he's sort of understanding, I don't want to give anything away, but he's understanding the ramifications of what has happened, and these footsteps are almost like army marching and train. I mean, it's very kind of a stressful sound, I would say.
Exactly. You know, it's almost like because you hear it early on in the movie, so it's almost like you hear that sound also in the opening scene of the movie. So it's almost like he knew it was coming too, right?
Interesting. For Tenet, you talked about that you spent the first meeting before reading the script with Nolan, and he played you vinyls and CDs, and you talked for a long time. Was it the same type of process here?
Yeah, it was. I mean, after we finished Tenet, you know, we still kept in contact, and like we're hanging out and watching movies or playing music, talk about art, and so I think that's an important part of the process and the collaborationship of like still keeping in touch and talk about art and seeing, you know, having that discussion, I think, is very important. So, you know, so when we started Oppenheimer, it wasn't, you know, we already had that relationship, and so we already knew each other, but even though we knew each other, he's never like, hey, I'm working on this thing right now, like it's about this, you know. It's always kind of very secretive about what he's doing, and so when I got the phone call, it was like kind of out of the blue. It's like, hey, you want to read the script next week or tomorrow? So I didn't go into reading, when I went started reading the script, I didn't really know anything about it before I started reading it. And I think that's a great way to approach things.
Besides the violin, did he have anything to offer up of what he wanted the soundscape to feel like?
Not really, no. Like he had the violin, and then my wife's the violinist, so I was able to, you know, we worked a lot together in the beginning to kind of create these, you know, experiments. So the first 3 months before Chris Nolan starts shooting a movie, he's in pre-production, and I sit down with him. I meet up with him once a week, and I play him the music that I've written. And then we analyze it, and we dissect it. We talk about the sounds. We talk about the melodies, what works, what doesn't work. And then we work on that for 3 months over and over and over again. So when he goes off to shoot the movie, he already has 3 hours of music to listen to.
He's also very hands-on. I remember you telling a story about a scoring session you had with a full orchestra, and you were saying something to the orchestra about, do that again in bar 24. And a little voice from the back said, no, it's actually 17. And you turned around, and it's Chris Nolan. What's it like to have, do you like having a director who's so hands-on and into, you know, or is it more of a difficult process?
No, in this case, it's a good thing. Like, but that's also because it is very inviting. He's also very inviting to my opinion and to my views, even though he has a crystal clear idea of what he's trying to do and what he's doing. Like, he knows, you know, I'm sure he was, you know, there's a very powerful moment with silence in a movie, you know, and I'm sure that was already in his head while he was writing the movie. So he has these crystal clear ideas, but he's also extremely open to my input and where I kind of sometimes I disagree, and we're having that exchange of ideas, and I think that's when magic really can happen, and we can push each other, and I think for this one, you know, we ended up with something pretty special, and that was because we had those we had those moments where we pushed each other further.
So I just saw the movie this morning, so I'm very full into it. So, but I have three spots I wanted to talk to you about, and you actually mentioned the one with Tatlock and the foot stomping. So we've talked about that, and I felt that something very emotional happened for me. One is when he's Oppenheimer's is like changing from a real military uniform to sort of the Oppenheimer uniform, the hat we know, the pipe, and there I felt something musically happen. Do you remember that scene I'm talking about?
Oh yeah, absolutely. It's you know, he's kind of becoming, you know, it's almost like, you know, there's all those in every superhero, there's always those scenes when he gets his cape, he gets his you know, the superhero gets his or her weapons, whatever it is, you know. So it's a powerful moment in the movie, and you know, it's his theme that's being played, but it's also kind of a throwback to the same theme that you feel like when he's a student, he's in a university, he's a student, and he's going to the museum, and you see this Picasso painting hanging on the wall, like in the IMAX on a huge screen, and that opening montage is kind of that's a very important piece of music there too, and it's a throwback to that music. And I remember when I saw, one of the first things that Chris showed me after I read the script was his visual effects experiments that he and Andrew Jackson was working on. They were working on creating the visuals when, you know, the atoms are spinning around in circles, and you have this beautiful like fluorescent lights created.
And gorgeous, yeah.
Yeah, and I remember sitting in that in the theater watching that, those lights hitting my face, and it was such a cool way of portraying that, and it's not digital, and so it feels timeless in a way, and that's how I wanted the music to sound like in those moments. So yeah.
And then of course I want to talk to you about thinking about and creating the music for Trinity, for the bomb, for this moment that changed history and is so many moral implications, not just for Oppenheimer and everyone who worked on it, but also for the world, of course. And this was an incredible segment, both visually and more than musically. Talk about that and what your feelings were going into making that.
Well, I think it's such a monumental part of the movie. Until that scene, like, the bomb has always been, like, you know, scribblings. It's been theory. It's been, you know, it's not a physical thing that you're, like, you know, you're actually touching it. You're hoisting it up in the air. You know, it's now real in a different way. So for me, right there, it's a big change in music there for that scene. You're going from, you know, a big orchestra, like lush music, to like these kind of really intimidating sounds. It's almost like more like a sound design. There's three elements, like this little ticking metallic sound, this like really rumbling bass, which is symbolizing the bomb, and you're going, and it really feels, I really wanted it to feel like this is a real threat. You know, this is actually bigger than what you thought it was going to be. You know, this thing, now you actually know that it could have potentially destroyed the whole world. And then obviously for the whole Trinity test, you know, there's a sense of urgency there that you haven't experienced before. And these guys, these scientists, I mean, they're taking bets if they're going to blow up the whole world or not. You know, it's kind of insane. And this actually happened in reality. Like, imagine even being there and being in the state that they were in at that time, to take bets on the possibility of destroying the whole world.
Of humanity.
Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about the process itself with Chris Nolan?
Yeah, so most of the music, like I said, they're done. I have 3 hours of music written before he starts shooting the film. And then, when he's finishing the movie, he finishes shooting the movie, when he starts editing, he starts to cut in my music in the scenes. So every part of the movie making is, everything is, he always sees the music and the movie in and hears the music and creates it. It's all an own world. You know, the music is its own DNA. It's not, you know, a lot of times when you start cutting a movie, most of the times, you know, people use temp music and they take in music from already existing movies and stuff, but Chris doesn't work that way. And we already created a bunch of music that he cuts into the scenes. And so when he has a first cut, there's already my music is already in there.
Mm-hmm.
And then from there on, we finesse it. Like we have like 3 or 4 months when we finesse it. I write a bunch of new music to picture. He has every Friday we watch the movie. We watch the movie down with Emma Thomas and Jennifer Lame, the editor, and we sit and watch it and watch the progress. And then next Friday we do the same thing and we see it just coming together and breathe. And it's like you're creating a, you know, creating something.
And how many Fridays was this? Months and months?
It was probably like it's probably for 3 months. Yeah.
Well, it was an amazing outcome. I don't have a lot of time, but I wanted to ask you a little bit about your influences right now. What are you listening to? Who are composers that if you had a young student like yourself at one time and you'd said, go listen to this, listen to Ludwig Göransson, but listen to this also.
Man, personally, I listen to a lot of jazz. I listen to a lot of classical music, and then I try to also listen to, and also listen to like the pop radio, and try to stay up to date with all the records that comes out every Friday. But are you talking about like specifically film scores or?
Yeah, tell me the last ones that you have listened to that have really affected you.
Well, I listened to, I think, what Daniel Pemberton did on Spider-Verse. I think, you know, both those movies are incredible. Like he's always like also pushing the, you know, the boundaries of sound, and I think it's incredible composer. And and also what, you know, I finished Succession a couple of days ago, and like just seeing that arc of music, how it takes place in those seasons, and how much music created for that, it's astonishing. And then I'm super excited to see Miyazaki's new film. You know, I think it came out yesterday. And Joe Hisaishi, you know, I love everything that he's done. And he never ceases to amaze me.
Ludwig, I've really wanted to talk to you for a long time. They want me to wrap up. Thank you very much for taking your time with me.
Of course. Thank you for having me.
Hejdå.
Hejdå.
Thank you so much to Ludwig Göransson. Oppenheimer premieres on July 21st, and make sure to see it on the largest screen available. And thank you so much for joining us. Pop Culture Confidential is a part of the Evergreen Podcast Network. Find it wherever you find your podcasts. See you next time.
I'm Anne-Marie Kelly. Wild Precious Life is a podcast about dreaming big, digging in and connecting across distance, division, and loss. In each episode, I talk with prize-winning writers, musicians, and wanderers who remind all of us how we can make the most of the time we have. So meet me here. Let's walk and talk and dream and discover what it means to be wild, precious, and brave.